for tuning in today. This is Red Eyes Radio, an independent radio program dedicated to providing you with answers to many of the questions that we find to be among the most important and interesting. Popular belief and the appeal to authority is not the gold standard here. We speak with independent authors, researchers, and thinkers that we hope will help to put much of the established wisdom of our times in perspective for you. We are not held back by political correctness or shy away from the controversial. We do in-depth investigations in order to get to the truth on a lot of different subjects. You might not agree with all our guests, and neither is that the point. We don't either, but we want to make you think and put the things you know in perspective and revise the things you thought you knew. Well, you can check out our archives at redicecreations.com. We also have redicemembers.com. Well, today we have Dr. Joseph Mercola with us, and we are going to focus on all things related to natural health. If we don't have our health, we can't fight those important battles, and it's a returning topic for us with this in consideration. Dr. Mercola is a licensed osteopathic and a board-certified family medicine doctor. He's an author and a wellness advocate. Osteopathic physicians practice, you know, a whole-person approach, treating the entire person, and applies a preventative approach rather than just treating the symptoms like so-called orthodox medicine does. His latest book is Effortless Healing. He's also written a book on the no-grain diet. We're going to speak about natural health and how to become and stay healthy. Hi, Dr. Mercola. Thank you so much for joining us today. I know how busy you must be, so it's great to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Well, I'm delighted to join you, Henrik. It's been a fan for a while.
Well, thank you so much. I've been an admirer of yours for a long time, too. And I've tried a lot of things health-wise myself over the years, on myself, I guess you could say, from trying being vegetarian for a while, even being vegan, and finally kind of coming out of all of that, going for an approach that is more rooted in, I guess the paleo angle to things, recognizing how our ancestors develop and under what conditions and so forth in order to stay healthy. And I've gotten so many good things from your website over the years. So just, thank you for your work and doing what you've been doing, you know?
You're most welcome. And that's actually a common journey and a path that many people take because there's so much confusion, misdirection, and deception in the media. And it's difficult to sort this all out. You know, my training as a physician, I'm just so passionate about health. So I take that passion and really interpret what the media is feeding us and try to present it into easy, digestible bits of information that people can easily apply.
You bet. Now, we're going to speak more about your book, Effortless Healing, today here and some of the surrounding issues. I know you've done so many good things, the GMO labeling issue. I want to ask you more about that later. But maybe first here, as a way, I guess most of our listeners would be familiar with you at this stage. But if not, can you just tell us a little bit when you kind of got into the more natural health approach? Have you always been interested in this?
A great question. I've been interested in health since a very early age. I started running in the late 60s, and then my passion just went to the point where I said, I've got to learn more about health. So I went to medical school, where I quickly became chairman of the Department of Family Medicine at my local hospital and was really entrenched and brainwashed into the conventional medical paradigm and had thousands of patients on prescription drugs. And then I sort of had an epiphany in the early 90s and realized that there was a whole network of physicians who had interest in natural healing techniques, and I was fortunate enough to connect with these and attend many, monthly postgraduate training sessions and traveling around the country to learn this information. And then it worked. Imagine that. I was able to get patients off of their drugs and actually took the position that if a person wasn't willing to try to get off of medication, then they really should find another doctor. And it initially dropped my practice dramatically, but then it increased quite tremendously, and I started seeing people from not only all over the country, but then from all over the world.
Yeah. So, and when did you start your website again, by the way?
Started the website in 1997, and it's grown over the last 12 years. We're the most visited natural health site in the world, and last year we had 80 million unique visitors, and that was up by 50%. So we're really reaching large numbers of people with this message, and it's such a crucial and important message to voice.
I agree. Yeah, well, that's great. People are really interested in these questions. And how can you not be? I mean, it's really the fundamental question to anything we do in life. If we're not healthy, then rest, follows after that, right?
Sure, absolutely.
So what is the underlying philosophy here, if I can put it that way, if there's such a thing? Do you think that for most part we have already have within us what we need in order to stay healthy?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the conventional medical philosophy is, of course, is that if you've got a symptom, there's a drug for it, and we're going to treat it with a Band-Aid. But really, the philosophy is what you alluded to earlier in your journey through health, and that the recognition that our bodies have adapted over thousands and thousands of years, if not longer. And as a result of that, our genetics and our biochemistry and metabolic systems are designed for what our ancient ancestors were exposed to. And the more closely we can replicate that lifestyle, the more likely we are going to able to optimize this biochemistry and genetics. So that's really the guiding principle I apply to understand all these new developments in sciences and put it against that framework and see if it makes sense. And it's so easy to sift through over 90% of it as hogwash immediately because it doesn't line up.
Exactly, and people have to understand the basic profit-driven agenda behind the pharmaceutical industry as well, and it's something we come up against again and again, and so many people can't cross that barrier of recognizing that, you know, even the FDA, you know, all these organizations, they have financial interests in what they're peddling to their people, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. And it's massive. There's, you know, we're talking tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. Just the healthcare economy in the U.S. is the largest portion of the economy. It's over $3 trillion every year, and that's just in the U.S. alone. So there's massive amounts of revenue at stake here in perpetuating this paradigm.
Absolutely. Now, if we get into effortless healing here a little bit, the subtitle to the book is 9 Simple Ways to Sidestep Illness, Shed Excess Weight, and Help Your Body to Fix Itself. What are some of the most, it's just so much to tackle here, of course, but what are some of the most problematic areas to why people are in ill health today?
Well, let me give you a basis for writing the book, because my last major book was The No-Grain Diet, written in 2004, 11 years ago, and it was a New York Times bestseller, and clearly ahead of its time, because obviously there were many the other individuals and professionals who promoted that concept, and you know, it's widely accepted as true now. In 2004, it wasn't. So it's 11 years later, I said it's time to put together a book, because we put out a daily newsletter, and each newsletter has, at least 2 to 3 articles, and it may take us several hundred or more articles to select down to those 2 or 3 articles. So there's lots of information that we go through. And so even at 600-700 articles a year for 10 years, we're looking at 7,000 articles, and each article is, you know, about 10 pages. So there's a lot of information in there. So what we realize is important is to not just give people information, but to also give it to them in an easy-to-understand format that condenses it and puts it in a simple-to-follow program. It's easy to understand. It compiles all the information in one easy reference. And the additional benefit, too, is that we have a large portion of our mission is philanthropic, where we support these ventures, initiatives to help people support their health. Because about 4 years ago, we realized that you can give people all the information and education in the world, but if there are impairments for their ability to implement the information, then what good is it? So that's why 4 years ago we started with the Health Liberty Initiative, which includes measures to support the removal of fluoride from the water, the removal of mercury from dentistry, and the labeling of GMOs and the education about the potential dangers and safeties of vaccines. So all the profits from the sale of this book actually go to support those nonprofit charitable organizations.
Very good. Now, obviously, all countries are not in alignment in terms of what approach to have to health. For example, you brought up mercury in dentistry and things like that. That's something that Sweden got rid of some years ago now, for example. So there's a ways we also can look at. It's not all very homogenized yet, where it's like, this is the approach to health and we need to tackle it. It's very...
With fluoride, too. There's a large portion of Europe that doesn't have fluoridated water.
Exactly.
And we've been... Actually, Mercury Initiative has been one of our most successful initiatives, because we supported Charlie Brown from Consumers for Dental Choice to attend these World Health Organization meetings all over the world, like in 5 or 6 different cities internationally. And they were, last year, I believe they were able to pass a ban on a treaty, a worldwide treaty, to eliminate the use of mercury in dentistry that's going to be enacted within the next, by 2020. So that was an exciting victory.
Very, very good. Now, let's get into some of the more aspects here of the book then, obviously. And one of the major areas as well that we have issues with today, at least in the Western world, I'd say, is that we sit too much. We do not move around. Tell us about this.
Well, you know, the simple soundbite here is sitting is the new smoking.
Right.
It really is. And you think, well, how could that be? Well, it's just as simple as lung cancer. If you're sitting more than 3 hours a day, you increase your risk of lung cancer as much as you do if you were regularly exposed to passive smoking. So it's just, it's just shocking, especially for someone like me who's really been very fit, probably in the upper 5%, more likely the upper 1% of the age rate specific population as I've, my entire adult life. You know, I'm exercise all the time, I'm doing these things, but yet, once I started the newsletter and shifted out of clinical medicine, I was sitting 16 hours a day. Yeah. Now, the average person is sitting 8, and for an office worker, it's 12 or 13. So, you know, this is something all of us are doing. I thought it didn't matter. I'm exercising. I'm fit. It does matter. And I couldn't believe the initial statistics that came out that showed that even if you were incredibly fit, an Olympic athlete, professional athlete, that your longevity was significantly diminished. So, you know, it doesn't have to be hard or expensive. Just stop sitting down.
Right.
Who would have known?
It's just so crazy. I mean, this is what we do, though. We spend our lives mostly in front of the computer. We don't have production works anymore, but we move around. These are service economies that we are in now, and this is what happens. We end up in front of the screen, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's okay to be in front of a screen. I'm still in front of a screen, I would dare say, easily 12 hours a day, but I'm rarely sitting down. You know, I was able to go from 16 hours a day of sitting to, on the average, less than 30 minutes a day, unless I'm traveling to a different location by air or car. But that's not common. So you can do it. And the simplest strategy to do is to stand up desk, and people say, well, is my boss going to pay for this? Well, it's interesting. I interviewed Dr. James Levine, who is one of the significant researchers at Mayo Clinic, and who's a leader in this field, and he's a consultant for many Fortune 500 companies and gives them specific tailored strategies on how to implement this into their workforce. And they find that invariably every company that does this, the health of their workers goes up, and more importantly for the business, their profits increase dramatically because people are healthier just by stopping the sitting. You know, conversion basically involves conversions to stand-up desk, which causes people to walk and move more, which is what we were designed to do. As I said earlier, the ancestral, replicating ancestral patterns. Our ancestors never sat down for 4 hours a day.
Yeah. So why is that, though? Is it the blood flow in your midsection that's kind of cut off? Or?
There's a whole variety of very powerful metabolic influences that occur when you simply stand up that involve insulin resistance, that involve the increasing your risk for other diseases. But part of it has to do with your blood pressure and movement and lymph flow, and hormonal changes. So it's just amazing what happens. And then the fact that you're actually working a little bit, because it takes a little more effort to stand up than it does to sit down. Not much, but, you know, over 8 hours a day, it adds up quite significantly.
Wow. So, okay, that's one aspect to this. Then, of course, we do have the exercise portion of this, too. What have you found in terms of what is ideal in order to stay healthy?
Well, as I said, that was my initial motivating factor to engage into a healthy lifestyle. And it's coming up on 50 years now. So I've made the mistake that I think the majority of your listeners are probably making today in realizing, and I did this mistake for 43 years, realizing that cardio or aerobics was the way to go. And back then, when I started exercise in 1968, let me set the frame for you, because I'm not sure how old you are if you remember back then, but this was when I started running in 68, people would throw rocks and beer cans at me because they thought I was a criminal.
Right.
I am not kidding you.
Wow.
This is absolute truth. And in fact, the standard of care in medicine, and this shows you how horrible the traditional standard of care is. The standard of care for heart attack in the 60s was 6 weeks of bed rest.
Wow.
That standard of care, which literally persisted, it stopped in the 70s, but it was for many decades. I think it started in the early 1900s. Probably is responsible for killing tens of millions of people. Tens of millions. So, I mean, but you know, there was just, it's just shocking how much misinformation is out there at a foundational level. So this was the frame. So anyway, that's a tangent. I thought it was an important one, though. So I was engaged in this for a long time, and then I realized that, you know, cardiovascular health is important. There are better ways and more effective ways to achieve it. So, you know, when I travel, I typically go to the fitness center in the hotel, and, you know, invariably I'll see people wasting a lot of time on the cardio machines, thinking they're getting a great workout. So I do use the cardio machines occasionally, but usually as an alternative to walk, because I like to walk about an hour and a half a day, and when I walk in, I'm typically reading. So it's hard to do when it's really cold out or it's inclement weather. But I don't do my regular exercise. Walking is a movement activity. So what I've come to appreciate is that you need two forms of exercise. One is just a simple movement, you know, not sitting down, standing up, and moving around. Maybe walking 7,000 steps, which is about 4 miles or so. I like to do things because I have the opportunity to do them a little bit as best I can. So I typically walk about 15,000 steps. But 7,000 is probably all you need a day, and there's actually simple fitness trackers and devices that you can use to easily measure that. You can, many of your smartphones, which is, if it doesn't do it by itself, there's easy applications you can download because they have these pedometer-like functions, little chips inside that allow you to do that. Yeah. And so doing that, combining it with two other important things that become progressively more important the older you become, which is involving yourself in some type of strength training program. It could be body weights, it could be regular weights or machines, but something where you're building muscle mass, because there's a condition called sarcopenia, which is the general tendency to lose muscle mass as you age, and you have to counteract that to stay healthy. So it actually could save your life. I had one of my personal trainers who was in his 30s, he was like 210 pounds into lots of muscle, got into a serious accident and literally went down to 140 pounds. He would have been dead if he didn't have that extra muscle mass. There's no doubt in my mind. Wow. So it can save your life, too, in acute situations like a trauma. So that's an important component. And then you do need some cardio. So you can do this. This is the other revelation is this high-intensity exercises where you engage. First, you warm up. You engage in a sprint, essentially, in a whole variety of different types of formats, and typically for about 30 seconds. Then you recover for about 90, and you repeat that for 7 more times, then you cool down. So that whole process takes about 20 minutes and is equal to 1 to 2 hours of cardio.
Wow.
And you don't have to do it every day. It's like 2 or 3 times a week.
Really?
Yeah, if you do it more than 3 times a week, it's actually going to make you worse because you're not giving your body enough time to recover, because recovery is really important when you're doing these high-intensity exercises or strength training. You just can't do it every day without expecting negative consequences.
Oh, let's put that in an evolutionary perspective. This is something that probably arose due to the fact that this is how we acted. Short spurts of really trying to get away from something potentially or whatever, you know, and then – this our body has developed in such a way that this is ideal for our bodies, right?
Well, certainly see that in nature. Even today, if you go out into the wild, you don't see many animals running marathons. I mean, occasionally you can make an argument that our ancient ancestors used to hunt down prey, and that's the way they were able to do that. They could run long distances and run down, you know, horses or whatever type of animal they were searching for, or cows. Not cows. I guess they wouldn't be. Whatever they have.
Yeah.
Their prey, whatever they hunted. So that was like a deer or something. So, you know, that's a strategy. But I think normally that's the type of activity that we were regularly engaged with, is these high intensity short spurt types of exercises. And when you replicate that, then you get all the beneficial metabolic and hormonal changes that occur that ultimately improve your health and help you prevent disease.
Are these relatively new studies that comes out and show this, or is this just by example you notice people's change?
The sitting is relatively new. About, even though it's relatively new, there's over 10,000 studies that support this, probably 15,000 by now. It was 10,000 last time I looked. But the intermittent and high-intensity exercises are probably a little bit older. I would say at least 10 years old, maybe longer than that. And there's enormous amounts of studies on this. And I don't, it's not, even at this point, it's not controversial.
Right, right, yeah. Intermittent fasting, you were almost mentioning that there. Tell us more about that.
Well, yeah, I got kind of confused with high intensity, because that's another important part of the program, which is in the nine steps in the Effortless Healing book that we go into in great detail. But it's an approach that also replicates these ancestral patterns. Because if you think back, think about it carefully, rather, our ancestors never had access to a grocery store 24/7.
That's right.
They just didn't. Yeah. They regularly went through times when they didn't have access to any food. So understanding that, the reality that our ancestors evolved from, or as I use the word evolved, but it came from, is that our whole system is designed for that. And when we eat food regularly and never take a break from it, then it's not surprising that we would encounter some metabolic challenges. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have so many problems with obesity in this country. It's not the only reason, for sure. And there's another interesting one that I'll go into in a moment, but that's certainly an important one. So I would say the majority of people listening to this in the Western world suffer from insulin resistance. So what is that? Well, your body needs insulin to burn fuel. If you didn't have it, you'd be dead. You'd go into a hyperglycemic coma and die. But the problem is that we rely on sugars as our fuels so much and never really take a break from food that our cells become progressively more resistant to insulin as a hormone. And as a result, we develop insulin resistance. And insulin resistance causes a host of complications. It's probably one of the central and primary factors why so many diseases, such as heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, arthritis, it's at its core. So if you're going to treat any of those diseases, you've got to resolve the insulin resistance. And if you don't, you're really kind of fooling yourself. That's why supplements by themselves can be useful, but they have to be targeted, and they have to really be integrated which is more important, is the application of a whole foods healthy lifestyle eating program.
Yeah.
If you're not doing that, it's not going to work, and you'll never resolve the insulin resistance. So in over 25 years of clinical practice, I have never seen a more effective intervention for resolving insulin resistance than intermittent fasting. So what is intermittent fasting? Well, there's a lot of ways to do this. There's a physician, Michael Mosley, in England, who's written the book The Fast Diet, and a really good guy. We're about the same age, and I've interviewed him in the past, and I was kind of angry with him because he got the name of that book, which is such a great name. The only better name for the diet of the book was the Eat Right for Your Type, which I don't agree with,
okay,
but
yeah.
It was a phenomenal name.
Yeah.
So anyway, he's got one strategy, and I have a little bit different. And there's a lot of different ways to twist it. They all involve essentially restricting calories for certain segments of time throughout the week. My approach is to limit your eating patterns or eating window to about 6 to 8 hours a day. So how do you do that? Well, the simple way is to make sure you don't eat anything before you go to bed for 3 hours. Sleep for 8 hours, because sleep's another important part of the program.
Yeah.
That is massively important, because you can get everything right, and if you're not sleeping well, you will get sick and you will die prematurely. There's no question about it. It's massively important and so commonly underappreciated and abused. Maintaining our sleep requirements. So you sleep for 8 hours, and then you gradually shift the time that you eat your first meal. Breakfast for most of us is unimportant and unnecessary, and the common belief it's the most important meal of the day, and that really probably was something propagated by the cereal companies. Now, it doesn't mean that this is perfect for everyone, certainly not, but if you have insulin resistance, it will probably help. If you don't have insulin resistance, then intermittent fasting is not something you need to do. And if you have an occupation that requires lots of hard work and heavy exercise and you're really using a lot of calories in the morning, then you need to eat breakfast and then maybe not eat dinner. So, it's just so long as you're honoring that restricted calorie window where you're eating. And why does it work? You might wonder, how does that work? Well, it works once you understand how our body uses energy, because we have to have energy. And most people, as I said, are using sugar or some type of carbohydrate. Grains could be considered a sugar. And they have it at least every 8 hours. Well, our body stores sugar. It doesn't have an infinite supply of storage like fat almost does. I mean, we can basically store hundreds of pounds of fat if we needed to in our body. But you can only store literally a few ounces of sugar, and it usually, maybe it's a little bit more, but it's a relatively small amount of sugar, and it's stored as glycogen in your liver and your muscles. And it typically lasts about 12 hours. And so if you're not eating any sugar and your body's not producing or making it, then you won't, you'll run out. And then here's the problem, Heinrich, is that when people run out, if they're eating all the time and they're insulin resistant, their body has forgotten how to digest and how to break down fat. So even though they have more than enough fat, they can't use it. And they get hungry. They're starving. They're craving food. Even they've got all this energy, this supplies in their body, they can't activate it. So it's a slow process. It usually takes a few days to a few weeks to teach your body how to remember how to burn fat. But once you do that, you seamlessly transition. And then this is one of the most amazing things about intermittent fasting is those hunger cravings, they literally disappear. It's nothing short of magical. You know, once you've transitioned over and your body remembers how to burn fat again, you can go without food for a while and you don't become hungry. I mean, eventually you do, of course.
Sure.
But, you know, going without, you know, some people might faint even thinking about going without food for that long, but they can do it. And they don't, and the value of having that as a resource tool in your body is that when you're traveling and the only food options you have are junk or even worse, you don't have to eat it because you can rely on your own body fat.
Yeah, yeah. So how do we get off that bad sugar cycle, if we can term it that?
Well, it's a simple process. I call it the 3-8-3, which I go into in the book, in that you stop eating 3 hours before you go to bed, sleep for 8 hours, and then gradually extend the time to be 3 hours later than you're eating breakfast now, to the point where, you know, you're 14 to 16 hours where you're not eating any food. And then your body will start to remember how to do that. And you continue that. You don't do this forever. This is not an eating program you maintain the rest of your life. You do this as long as you have insulin resistance. How do you know if you have insulin resistance? That's a good question, right?
Yeah.
So you can go to the doctor and they can measure a fasting blood insulin, not blood sugar, blood insulin level. And if it's less than 3, you don't have insulin resistance. If you don't want to get a blood test, you can simply look at your body and answer these questions. Do you have diabetes? Are you overweight? Are you taking a statin drug? So if you answered yes to any of these questions, then it's likely that you have insulin resistance.
Hmm.
Or the other one that I forgot is if you have high blood pressure, because at the core of all those diseases is insulin resistance.
Ah, interesting. So, of course, a lot of this centers around eating right, and that's one of the main battles is taking place today, I guess, and a lot of emotions and everything else. And as I said before, I did the vegan thing for a while, and I did feel really good for some time.
Oh, there's a lot of good components about a vegan lifestyle. I mean, 80% of it is terrific. I just think you need a little bit animal fat and protein.
Right, right. And is that what you would say to those people as an addition to something that
it's about
the fat?
It depends. You know, I tend to refrain from engaging in any philosophical debates because there are a number of reasons why people choose to be a vegan.
Of course.
And a vegan means no animal foods at all. As opposed to vegetarian, which there's a lot of different flavors of. But if a person is choosing to engage in a vegan lifestyle for ethical or moral reasons, there is no argument. I mean, that is their decision, that's their right, and if they choose to do it, that's fine. Just as long as they're aware of the potential health complications. But there's no way you can argue with that. None. Zero. Nada. So that's their choice. But if they're doing it to improve their health, then that's a different discussion.
Yeah, yeah. Now, tell us about fat then as a fuel as opposed to sugar. This is very important, and we've unfortunately thrown this out again much in the Western world. All the science, I know they're pushing this in Sweden all the time, of these margarines and these other types of fat
and
all that.
We're really making massive improvements. In fact, the cover of story for Time magazine last year was Butter is Back, you know? And it really is. That was based on a book by Nina Techholt, so I forget the name of her book, but she reviewed the evidence, and it was a great book. I actually interviewed her recently too, and the there are a large numbers of studies that well, first of all, fat has been vilified since the 50s, thanks to Ansel Keys. And that's where, and I fell into the same darn trap. In the 70s, I had a low-fat diet. My diet was so low in fat. My exercise program was such that my cholesterol level was 70, 7-0.
Oh.
I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Wow.
So that, you know, that's part of the reason why I do this site and write these books and articles is to help people not make the same mistakes I did. They don't have to be caught up in this nonsense. So, but it turns out that fat is healthy. Now, it certainly needs to be done in proper balance. And not all fats are healthy. You know, you have to have healthy fats. What is a healthy fat? Well, most plant fats are healthy, and by those I would mean like coconut oil or avocados or certain nuts, and nuts that are particularly good are macadamias and pecans because they're relatively low in protein, because you can overeat protein. That's a potential problem too, and we can talk
about
that.
Right, yeah.
So you don't want to overeat protein, but it's difficult, if not almost impossible, to overeat vegetables. It's really difficult to do that. So you get as many vegetables as you want.
No.
But fat can be problematic, and it's actually potentially even more dangerous than sugar, which is particularly pernicious. But if you have fat that's heated, it forms trans fats. It has a potential to form trans fat. It depends on the initial starting fat. And it forms even worse things like cyclic aldehydes. So heating fat can be really problematic and increase insulin resistance even worse than sugar. So that's a major problem. And if your diet consists of a lot of these fried, factory farmed or factory processed foods and oils, then that's going to be definitely a problem. So you can't just liberally have any types of fat. But healthy animal fats would include things like fat from healthy animals or healthy organic grass-fed raw butter, are particularly good. And I try to have about a pound of butter a week myself. I think it's really great because it has lots of good nutrients in there that are difficult to get, these oil-soluble nutrients. Now, when you're in the process of trying to resolve insulin resistance, it's probably helpful to have larger amounts of these healthy fats and less amounts of the carbs, like, you know, only really only restricting your carbohydrates to vegetables because the grains are easily processed to sugars. And then also, if you have excessive protein, your body converts that to extra sugar too. So most people eat too much protein in general. Now, sometimes you need a lot of protein if your goals are competitive bodybuilding or you're just exercising or working a lot. Then you may need more protein. But most people eat probably 2 to 3 times more than they need.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's right. By the way, is there a good source where you get your grass-fed butter?
Yeah, the best way to do that is to find one of the reasons why it was triggered me to contact you so that we can have an interview is that you interview Sally Fallon, and who's with the Weston Price Foundation. And Sally has done an enormously beneficial strategy, literally probably a testament to her biggest accomplishment in her life, is developing this network of Weston Price chapter leaders, which are all over the world. And these chapter leaders are probably close to where you are now, and you just identify them. They can be easily found on the internet on her website. And then these chapter leaders are networked within the local community to know where these resources are, so how you can hook yourself up into the supply chain.
Excellent.
That's really one of the best ways.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. It's a very good idea. Now, we're kind of going through, obviously, some of the 9 steps that you have in the book here, and let's just kind of carry on there and talk a little bit more about water, immensely important thing.
I suspect you have a bit different audience than the typical American population, so they're more educated. But for those who are not, or those who have relatives who are still really caught up in the old paradigm and are interested in taking measures to improve their health, the single most important step that anyone can take who's stuck in that paradigm is to stop drinking soda, especially diet soda, because artificial sweeteners are just worse than regular sodas. And they're showing now that the research is really clear that it does not cause you to lose weight. In fact, the FTC should sue these companies for false claims because there's no evidence to support that it's weight loss, and that you're able to fraudulently use the word diet. It actually causes them to gain more weight and other complications. So stay away from that and just switch to simple, pure water. Now, maybe in the next hour we can go over some of the other advanced strategies that you can use for water, because I want to go over some of these other things. But there's there's a lot of ways that you can improve your water, it's absolutely fascinating. You know, it's just getting down to the basics. But if you get the basics right, everything else falls into place.
Well, exactly. You had in your initial thank you note in the book as well, you had Paul Connett. We had him on a while back too, and the fluoride issue is so incredibly important, and a lot of people unfortunately still are not they're not getting why that is so bad for us. You know.
Yeah, they don't understand. That's huge. As I said, it's one of our health liberty initiatives, and the portion of the profits of the book go to support Paul's work, because he's been a really phenomenal activist at helping educate the world and transition out of this and inspire communities to fight the battle to remove fluoride out of their water supply.
I'm blown away by the fact that so many people still fall for the aspect that you know, this is what is recommended as a health initiative, and they do it. You know,
I'm not surprised, I think you would be either, because you know so much about the how the whole system works, and they're very clever, very sophisticated, been doing this for a long time. There's lots of money behind this. They're able to hire some of the most brilliant marketing advertisers to essentially brainwash people, and they do it at a deeper level. You know, there's this quote. I'm going to get my computer because I think it was really appropriate.
Yeah, no worries.
I got from David Icke. I was watching one of his videos recently, and it was about ignorance. And this really relates to the whole concept of the media, which is a tangent. Here it is. You can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
That's right. Yep.
So, and that's what they've done. They've done it in so many clever ways. There's only six companies that control like 85% of the media in the world. So it's controlled by this small group of individuals who really are responsible for providing the information that comes to us. And then how else do they do it? They do it through the medical journals. And, you know, there's lots of information out there, like former editors of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, like Marcia Angell, that said that she wouldn't trust much of what's written in a medical journal because of the whole process. And who would know better than one of the editors of the top journals in the world? So there's lots of fraud and chicanery that goes on and misinformation. So that they have something called key opinion leaders that the pharmaceutical companies identify and target, and they're able to give these people large amount of money, and through nefarious ways are typically cleverly hidden, you know, typically hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars sometimes.
Yeah.
And they do that because it's a phenomenal, it's a magnificent investment on their part, because they're able to reach so many other people, and they're able to, they may be a chairman of a committee that's responsible for setting these standards and developing the standard of care within a particular medical discipline. So, and that has enormous influence, and they'll be the voice in all these editorials and major medical journals. So they essentially establish the standard of care, and it is so difficult to refute the standard of care, because even if you start to do it, your local medical board will want to challenge your license and reprimand your license and maybe even take your license because you disagree with what is accepted as a standard of care. But that standard of care has been carefully crafted through these companies. I mean, it's really a very clever and sophisticated system, and these companies really are brilliant, and they know how to do it well. So that's why I'm not surprised.
No, I am not either. But at the same time, I mean, the studies are there for those who want to look at it. The science is there. Yes. It's really a conspiracy of omission, you know?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
And we have to pierce through that marketing and cycle. I mean, you do great work on that, but it takes. I get to a certain extent, it has to be a driving and a spark within people that they want to try to learn not only about themselves but their body, how to become healthy, right?
That is, and many times it's not really motivated or catalyzed until they encounter a personal crisis.
You know, exactly.
They don't start moving until they have like stage 4 terminal cancer. You know, by that point it's too late. I can't tell how many people have contacted me indirectly through friends or relatives who are at that point. And by that time, it's too late. I mean, that's it. Yeah. The brother-in-law of one of my good friends I mean, he's called me with 1 week to live, and
oh boy,
you know, and he just passed away. But you need a little reserve time. But you know, typically what happens is that they're so overwhelmed with everything else. There are other responsibilities, engaged, and you know, it's just tough. The middle class is being decimated. They don't have any extra income, and they're forced to work. Two couple families are working, and not two couples, that both spouses are working in a home typically. So there's not a lot of free time, let alone time to carefully analyze it. So they just trust these experts, and that's the most efficient way and effective way that they have. And unless they're really confronted with some type of imminent or acute tragedy, you know, they just don't have the time to explore, and they just accept the traditional approach.
Yep, absolutely. It's very, very sad. You know, but one way, of course, we can do this is just by enjoying the outdoors more, getting proper sun, going barefoot in the grass, in the dirt, right?
I couldn't agree more. And one of my new lifestyle measures I've been involved with the last 6 months or so is, after talked about, you know, my recognition, appreciation of the importance of movement. And so I got myself a nice little fitness tracker, and I walk on the beach pretty much every day that it's nice, because I live no close to the ocean, and it's subtropical, so the weather's good most of the time. And walk for about 6 miles with my shirt off, getting my sunshine, fresh air, nature, and I read. So it's, you know, it's a pretty interesting multitasking component that allows me to read two or three books a week and lead a healthy lifestyle that, you know, allows me to optimize my resources.
Absolutely. Now, we have another segment here later coming up. I want to ask you more about the GMO initiative. You've done so much good work on this, but one thing I wanted to ask you about before we take a break here in a little bit is about, you mentioned it to me off the record, but your top story right now is about, of course, we're recording this on April 1st, I can say here, but it's about the mandatory vaccination program. But in reality, though, this is not that out of bounds. This is a real reality.
We upset a lot of people today because, you know, they trust us to give them truthful information, but they should know that we have a record on April 1st of giving one that's not truthful, but it's close to the truth. And the reason why so many people got distressed with this is that it could really happen. I mean, especially this year, earlier this year, and we had I've never seen a more vicious assault on those who oppose regular vaccines and question the safety and efficacy.
Yeah.
I mean, they were vilified as anti-vaxxers, and I'm probably viewed as one of the king of the anti-vaxxers. Even though I'm not an anti-vaxxer, I'm just pro-vaccine safety, pro-vaccine choice. And there's just not enough of that in this whole thing. So, I mean, this whole Disneyland and measles, and I know you've had people on in the past going into the details, but I've never seen such a massive assault. I mean, it was just incredible. So anyway, we did this article saying that there was mandatory vaccines that are imposed, even though we had a lot of things like the biosafety alert or the BS alert. But the sad reality is that it could happen, and that's, you know, it's of all the initiatives we're involved with, I don't think we'll win on this one in our lifetime, but we hope to prevent the implementation of some tragic strategy that the government is working towards. And I really do believe they are clearly working towards mandatory vaccination.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's been done in the past. If you read other books on historically, in certain communities, not at a federal level, but in certain local communities, they implemented these things to the point where they would – I read stories where the police would come in and, like, close all the doors in a factory and forcefully vaccinate the people, or even shoot people running away that would refuse to get vaccinated.
Oh, my God.
A smallpox vaccine. I mean, that literally is happening. You just have to look at history to avoid repeating it. But, I mean, it's not some type of fantasy. It could definitely go to that level.
What are some of the main things that you worry about when it comes to the vaccination issue?
Well, the primary one is the safety. It really is safety, and does it work? And, you know, are there better strategies? You know, I'm clearly for preventing infectious diseases, and I'm grateful for interventions that do that. But if you look carefully at the history of vaccines, you'll see that the incidence of the disease prior to the implementation of the vaccine program was dramatically on a decline before they even implemented them. So it was maybe the disease was maybe 90, 99% gone before they implemented it. Then they introduced the vaccine. The vaccine gets the credit for eradicating the disease, which wasn't the case at all. It was these other measures, which are just in the case of measles. I mean, it is very clear that measles responds to vitamin A and protein calorie malnutrition. If you have enough vitamin, because measles can be a really dangerous infection. It's wiped out thousands and probably tens of thousands of individuals in the past. But that was usually in populations that were not properly immunized, that had horrible living conditions. I mean, they were talking about people living in these large cities that, you know, crowded conditions with poor sanitation, terrible nutrition, no sunshine, no exercise. Yeah. It was just awful. It was lucky they were alive. So, of course, they're going to come down with sickness and illness. And it's no surprise they would come down with these illnesses. So you address the cause, and all of a sudden the condition disappears. You know, and then these vaccines, they don't confer the same type of immunity that a natural infection were. So a lot of times we're afraid of getting these infections. But if you're healthy, an infection is not necessarily a bad deal. Maybe a little rash or a little cough or cold or something, symptoms, and that's it. Then you have lifelong immunity that will protect not only you, but your, you know, others. So we're making these trade-offs typically at the benefit of these pharmaceutical companies, which are current. I believe it's like $15 billion a year in revenue right now from the vaccines. It's going up to $50 billion in the next few years.
Oof. Yep, that's an incentive right there, people. But we're talking here with Dr. Mercola about his latest book, Effortless Healing, Nine Simple Ways to Sidestep Illness, Shed Excess Weight, and Help Your Body to Fix Itself. And I have a copy right here. I've started to go through it, and there's just so many good tips in there, and it's very simple, of course, as well. I want to talk a little bit more about how people can pick up copies of this book and what formats and whatnot you have it available in. But is there anything else you want to mention about the book before we do that?
No, again, it's the profits for this book. It's not something that we're designed, you know, it's two primary purposes. One is to serve people in a way that makes it easy for them to understand and apply the principles that we've been teaching over the last 20 years. And then also to use all the profits from this are being donated to support the charities that really are engaged in helping health freedom in the U.S. and remove these dangerous toxins from our environment like fluoride, mercury, and GMO or glyphosate, and then also maintaining our current freedom to still have the luxury of being able to opt out of the vaccine program and not have it mandated. So this is where the profits of the book are going towards. So it's available in any format. But, you know, I like Kindle books. It's on a Kindle. It's on hardcover, not paperback, and it's also on audio and CDs.
And give us a website. You have so many good things on your website, regular updates, articles, information.
That's my last name, Mercola, M-E-R-C-O-L-A, MERCOLA.com. And, you know, we've got – it's a free daily newsletter that really provides this information and all the research and to expose all of these regular frauds that are coming out and deception, and so that the government will announce this new study or the media does, and then we will tend to break it apart and so why this isn't a breakthrough, what's flawed or fraudulent with it. So, and then we have interviews with some of the leading experts in the world, too, that go into great detail. Kind of like somewhat what you're doing. You know, my typical interviews are about an hour and a half or so. And then we break it down to like 15 minutes for people who don't have a lot of time, but if they want to watch the full one, and there's no charge for that, it's all free.
All right, very good. It's an excellent website, and I was going to say as well, you have a store where you have sourced a lot of good things, of course. So it's an easy access for a lot of the things that I would recommend to people as well in terms of what they can and should be looking into when it comes to supplements and these kinds of things. So if you're not familiar, folks, do take a look, Mercola.com. And again, the book Effortless Healing, we'll have a link up to that from our website as well. But Mercola, we'll take a short break here, and thank you everybody for staying with us. We'll be right back after the break. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, in the second hour with Dr. McCullough, we speak more about his participation in the GMO labeling initiative, Proposition 37. Why it's such an important question to deal with. He donated over $1 million to this cause and has done tremendous amounts of work in this department. And I think McCullough is a bit too humble to discuss that in much detail. But the fact is, he's been very generous and he's very passionate about trying to get the GMO question not only under control, but also get it out to people so that they can understand better how to make choices about this. And of course, when we speak more about GMOs and the microbiologists involved, I think you'll understand why this is the case. We also talk about glyphosate or Roundup produced by Monsanto. This is a truly terrifying aspect that is incredibly dangerous. We're going to some of the more advanced water strategies in order to get good drinking water. We talk about structured water, spring water, filtered water, and various ways to clean up this essential component in staying healthy. And later we discuss xenoestrogens, chemicals, plastics, BPA, phthalates, and other materials that we get exposed to that is incredibly disruptive to our endocrine system, very detrimental to men's testosterone levels and women's too, as there's an overload of estrogen out there these days. As we move forward, we talk about different nutritional types, and McCullough shares with us some of the so-called superfoods that you should stay away from if you want to remain healthy. All right, so we'll pick this up right after the break. If you want to hear more, you can sign up for a subscription with us and tune into this and any of our previous programs. We spare you from commercial interruptions. We are not on a big radio network, and we do not have blinking website banners. So if you like what we do and want to hear more, you can go to redicemembers.com. You can find all the details there. A subscription is just €5 per month, by the way. And we have subscriptions going from 3 months, recurring or non-recurring, all the way up to 2 years, whatever works for you. Right, but before we proceed here, I just want to let you know about our upcoming guests. We have Mike Cross, Daniel Spaulding, Marion Bencourt, Joseph Atwill, Brandon Martinez, and Brian N.C. Patrick. Okay, this concludes the first hour, but stay with us. A second hour with Dr. McCullough is coming up right after the break.